hour, we will cover topics and news related to visual digital arts in all its forms. Welcome to Digital Sites. We air every first Thursday of every month here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Stay tuned.
Okay, so hello everybody and welcome to today's talk, The Work of Video Games, Reflection on Game Worker Organizing. My name is Jamie, and I'm the author of Marks at the Arcade. And I'm really pleased to introduce today the two other speakers, Austin, who's the former chair of the Game Workers branch of the IWGB, and Emma, who is the campaign lead of the Code CWA campaign. And we're going to talk through a couple of issues about the history of organizing in the games industry, about what's happened more recently, and maybe even what might happen in the future. I thought it might be nice just to start talking about how we each got involved in the games industry and thinking about games, just as a kind of bit of background before we get into some of the kind of meatier bits. So Austin, you know, what was your kind of route into the games industry, into thinking about these things?
So like 13 years ago or so, or actually, no, let's go 17 years ago, I went to a college in Seattle, Washington in the US. And it was basically a school dedicated to teaching how to make video games. So I did that for about 4 years and then, you know, got a job as a programmer at Midway shortly after. And have been in the industry for like 13 years since. So it's a very, very brief overview of it, but yeah.
And how about for you, Emma? What was your route?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so I went to a university program as well, got into the games industry. I actually come out of film primarily as my background, but moved into games over time, narrative, production, QA, you know, I did the works. I've always been involved with some form of like political and labor and community organizing. I used to like run like you know, volunteering and also coordinating like election campaigns and stuff. I think I got my first like labor organizer training in like high school, and then you know when I moved into the games industry as like my primary career focus, just felt natural.
So I mean, I guess you know one of the things that's always that's interested me about this is, you know, when you talk with lots of workers today at the moment, you know, there are lots of people who are trying to get organized during COVID or, you know, thinking of taking the first steps. And, you know, the conversations I always have with people, it's ah, well, you know, my industry is really specific or it's really different or, you know, there are challenges in my industry that mean it's harder or so on. And I guess, you know, from your route in, you know, what do you think is like specific about the games industry? Like what specific challenges do you think there were, you know, I guess Emma, like compared to film or compared to other places?
That's a great question. It's not the answer anybody really wants to hear, I don't think, but my honest opinion is I do not think it's all that unique. In that I don't think there's some magical special thing about games that makes it either possibly hard or incredibly easy. I think, you know, when it comes to organizing, it's first and foremost a social like activity, right? You're like building relationships, you're building trust, you're like building community, right? That's the primary thing. I feel like there's like, such a wide diversity of disciplines in the games industry and people wear so many hats. And it's not very clean cut. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really interesting. And I think that really insists on an industrial union model approach where all the different disciplines are working together. If you work together, you should be in the union together. Not divvied up into 12 different hyper-specialized random little craft unions. So I think that's one thing worth noting. But you know, in general, like I tend not to like let people off the hook with the notion that organizing a game is like some extremely special thing. It's just a challenge. And
yeah, I kind of wonder a bit about that connection because you know there had been industrial action in the games industry preceding what's happened in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. you know, with voice actors, for example, coming from different industries, of whether that kind of mixture of different kinds of work kind of helps with people having had, you know, experience in the film industry or elsewhere. You know, it's games is a isolated thing that, you know, people have never done anything else, you know?
No, I think you're totally right. Like, there's like little seeds from other pockets of organizing that I do think have really helped. I think SAG-AFTRA is definitely correct. There's a fair bit of like animators who have had prior experience, you know, editors, things like that, writers. I would also say like, but yeah, there's like a fair number of disciplines that have had experience elsewhere. I'd also argue like the games press has become increasingly unionized over the past like 5 to 6 years. And that has really resulted, I think, in a remarkable shift towards more and more real professional coverage of the industry, not just, wow, this new game's out, let's all, you know, obsess over whatever the latest EA thing is. But instead, like, you know, we also tend to get more deep dives into the back end of what the industry really looks like, what it's like to live and work in it, you know, what are kind of the guts of the industry, right? Which I think is really interesting stuff. And I think that allows the audience, the industry, and press to kind of engage deeper and deeper coverage of the industry. And that, I think, also helps build, like, a general cultural knowledge that's really helpful for work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the games industry press thing is one of those things that, like, if you didn't know about it, you would have just thought, oh, they got loads of great coverage initially. And then when you dig into it, as you say, it's like, you know, if people are unionizing in their own publication, they're obviously going to be more union-friendly in the coverage they do, which was a kind of nice additional benefit, I guess.
I would actually tweak that in that, you know, the vast majority of media under, you know, capitalism are controlled by major, like, millionaires, billionaires, corporations, right? I mean, Washington Post, ultimately, it's owned by Jeff Bezos. And, like, you can claim editorial, you know, neutrality and stuff, but we all know the reality of the situation. They have advertising things to hit. Unionization, I don't think necessarily makes it more pro-union directly. I actually think unionized journalism allows for more editorial independence because they have power to push back against that corporate influence. And that just defaults to being more hospitable to pro-worker sentiments, I think.
Yeah, and sense? I guess, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's, a unionized press is much freer to say things that might, you know, wrangle with people. I guess also a few of them had, you know, it's not like they just unionized, like a few of them had campaigns. They were like involved in organizing themselves, which I'm sure helps to write about organizing when you've, you know, you've done it and you've been kind of a part of it. So Emma, you're saying that you had experience organizing elsewhere and then brought it into the games industry?
Yeah, that's right.
So what do you think, like, in the US context, like, why did it happen? I mean, I know these are kind of counterfactual sometimes, but, like, why do you think that organizing happened when it did, in the way it did? You know, how did you get involved? What do you think was kind of happening at the time, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think part of it will always be, like, hunting for a perfect answer, which doesn't really exist. Honestly, I think it was just a real tipping point. Like, I think the press becoming increasingly, you know, industry focused, I think just something that just sparked that tinder that was already there and a fair bit of sentiment was just like notion of some previous like VP executive studio that failed because she drove into the ground was hosting a pros and cons of unions talk at GDC. And it's just like, the hell on? Like, it's just like, enough of us who gave a shit about those things and was actually paying attention to those things were like, okay, this is terrible. We should actually have opinions on this and we should get some people in that room. And then there was so much energy that actually we were going to support.
Yeah, losing the audio a little bit.
Okay.
I guess just while we're getting that sorted, it might be worth just for people, not everyone I think will know what GDC is.
I can describe that if you want.
Yeah, that would be great.
So GDC's the Game Developers Conference, which is kind of the biggest game development related conference every year, aside from this one due to COVID stuff. But usually there's 10,000-15,000 people that show up in San Francisco for a week or so and just talk about game development from pretty much every aspect. And oftentimes it's a place too where people can meet up and see each other because we're spread across the globe so much. So it's kind of like a unique focal point for the entire industry.
Which I guess when you say it like that, it sounds like a great place to start kind of an organizing effort. But I mean, I guess there's also, you know, as someone who has to go to conferences from time to time, they're not always, it wouldn't strike me as necessarily the a place to do some of those things. So it's a bit kind of, I guess, yeah, it gave a focus point to people perhaps. So what? How did you get into all of this?
Yeah, basically I saw what was happening at GDC and I was in London, so I wasn't actually at GDC. Saw like all the news reports and everything like that, and basically followed the Game Workers Unite account on Twitter, signed up for all the emails and stuff like that, because I've had some, you know, some of the typical experiences in the games industry with like excessive crunch and bad treatment by employers and all that. So I was pretty keen to try something new, and then the UK chapter of it came out, and they had a meeting in London in August of 2018, and so I went to that, which was one of the bigger meetings, the first ones, and just started getting more and more involved after that, and eventually became chair much later on.
And it might also be worth just explaining what crunch is for some people, because it doesn't sound as horrible as it actually is in lots of ways.
Yeah, it's kind of a nefarious term because it sounds cutesy. But what it is basically excessive overtime, which is oftentimes unpaid. So overtime upwards of 60 or 80 hours a week. And in some cases, it can be like 100, 110 hours a week or something like that, which basically means you are working, you know, 14, 16 hours a day. You go home, you sleep a little, and then you go straight back to work. So it comes with a lot of pretty serious issues, you know, some health issues, some both physical and psychological. And oftentimes this can go on for months or sometimes years even.
Also worth noting that I think it really impacts the quality of the game too. Like, I don't think, like, I was a former production manager and like, I don't know, like just shoving more crap into a small period of time does not necessarily mean you get a good big quantity of content. Usually it's just like people are dead and are just trying to slam jam it before it's done, right? And that's not going to make a quality game. So it's like kind of bad for players, bad for the company, bad for workers, in my opinion.
So why do you think it happens?
Oh, because it's just like really basic short-term return on investment. That's literally it. It's not good for the long-term health of the company because you get brain drained and stuff. Because people burn out and don't do good work.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's a kind of very traditional workplace issue in lots of ways. You know, like getting people to work without paying them for all their time.
Pretty much, yeah.
And, you know, if you're getting someone to work 100 hours a week versus their 45 or whatever they should be working, you know, you're getting double time for the same wage. Although, as you say, probably, you know, that extra chunk of time might not actually be adding that much to the game, hey?
Yeah, I think there's a sense of actually like toxic masculinity that goes along with it too. The sense of like, if I just push through and push harder, then I can get this done. Even though there's actually been like tons of studies on overtime, and it basically amounts to like, you are actually like less effective after 2 weeks of continuous overtime than you are if you had just like done, you know, the normal hours for that extended period. So it's actually like, there's studies saying that it like doesn't work, and the industry as a whole knows this, but it still does it anyway, which is pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the things that I found so kind of such a clear cut kind of thing that people could organize around of, you know, the effects, as you say, it then has a broader effect on the industry too of, you know, not everyone can work those kind of long hours. It's harder to have other responsibilities and so on. So it shapes the workforce also in kind of particular ways, I guess. And of course, you know, it's been in the news quite a bit more recently with lots of people reporting on it, like we were talking about earlier, Emma. You know, CD Projekt Red hasn't had favorable press coverage around crunch in the last couple of weeks.
To say the least, which is fair. I have a friend in CD Projekt Red who, you know, when the company first announced, like, oh, we're definitely not going to crunch, he just started walking around telling everyone, like, that's obviously horseshit. Watch. 2 months from now, when we're really loaded or whatever, they're going to be pushing us to do it one way or another. And here you go. It's like these companies, they really do operate like clockwork, which in some ways makes organizing so much easier because you can really just call their shots because it's really easy to tell, like, what is the greediest, most money-grubbing way to go about this? Okay, let's plan for that, right? And nine times out of 10, it's perfectly exactly what is going to happen.
It's also, too, like I would say, don't pay attention to what they say. Pay attention to what they do.
Yes.
And like, kind of like Emma says, like, it's clockwork. And, you know, they can say one thing like, oh, we've changed. We're not going to do it anymore. Or, you know, we're going to give whatever to the workers. But, like, you know, the proof is in the pudding. I don't know where that phrase comes from, but yeah, like it really matters more what they actually do than what they say.
Yeah, and I think, you know, particularly now some of those issues have become ones that are talked about much more widely. Of the fact they said that they wouldn't do crunch is a kind of, you know, at least then means you have a kind of flashpoint where when they then do it, you can kind of turn that back around.
Yeah, and that is productive in that way, like, even though ultimately words don't matter, but it is good at shifting kind of the mental state, and the companies think, oh, we need to advertise that we're not doing crunch and we're not driving our workers into pits of despair, that way we'll sell more, right? It's at least something, but I don't think just, you know, marketing pressure is the right way to go about it. Obviously the thing we need is, like, us, the workers, to actually have agency and power in over our own lives, not just being thankful when the parents decide to let us not burn out and crunch.
Yeah.
Question come in that's actually directly related to this. So I think it's worth us thinking about. Someone saying, do we think it's possible to make big modern games without crunch? Or does the format of these massive 60-hour plus open world games require it in some way?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's absolutely silly because there are just thousands upon thousands of people who make these games, and you could just have 1.5% more people, right? Just, like, hire more people, and Lord knows these games make enough revenue. Like, we're talking about games that bring in multi-million dollar revenue, and there's massive profits that go directly to, you know, really fun CEOs who definitely do a lot of work and are really valuable in their companies. And, like, no, we could just pay people more, we could hire more folks. End of story.
Yeah, I think that any time a company crunches, it's basically a production failure. Either they could, you know, hire more people or cut scope, essentially, like, do less, or oftentimes it's even just like there's kind of like a certain type of perfectionism that's within the games industry as well, which is like, oh, this has to be perfect, and one person constantly changes their mind. And so, like, just being okay with going a singular direction and not constantly changing your mind. Like, there's all kinds of ways to like help mitigate production issues. And the games industry barely does any of them a lot of the times. And so that's why things go out of scope. And that's why things like run long. I think also just people are very unrealistic about how long things take. And so they'll say, like, oh yeah, I'll have this done in a month. And, like, 5 months later, they're still working on it. So, yeah.
So we can blame management. Is that what you're saying?
I think to some degree, yeah. I mean, like, if a company is continually producing something and it takes way longer than they say it's going to, then it's management's responsibility to own up to that and say, like, yes, that's our fault. Like, we're not running the company well if we are constantly a year late or 2 years late or something like that. Like, that is absolutely their fault.
Can I provide a bit of a counterpoint? Like, I kind of think it's also on us, too. Like, don't get me wrong. management is the one who has power in the situation. They control the finances. They can definitely fix these things if they want to, assuming it's a stable company. But it's also on us too, like the workers. Like, we need to be able to advocate for ourselves and not just hope that management fix things. And that's why we have to organize to build the actual power, so that way we're not just hoping they do the right thing. We like can force them to do that. And I'm
specific. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, that is a really good point.
I just think there's like a real dialectic kind of tension between that, where like we're pushing for worker agency, but there is a reality of like managers have the power, but like we can't use that as a cop out of like, well, everything's bad and that's the manager's fault. Maybe we could get together and fix that shit.
Yeah, I think maybe there's a distinction between like the people who are capable of doing it versus the people who are responsible for the outcome of it.
Yeah, I like that.
So maybe it's a good opportunity to ask you a little bit more then about what's been happening in the US kind of since GDC over the last couple of years. Like where's the organizing gone?
Yeah, great question. I mean, so, right after GDC, I mean, immediately kind of the next things that happened were people dispersed back out to their cities and regions and studios and started organizing local chapters of Game Workers Unite. And, you know, trying to just build the framework of like some core education and community building and mapping and research about the industry in their areas.
Like, have there been any moments that you can talk about that kind of give a sense of where things are up to in the US?
Yeah, totally. I mean, obviously there's all kinds of stuff like the riot walkout around forced arbitration and the improvements they were able to make, you know, the Activision Blizzard stuff, tons of things I can't really speak to presently. There's also the Voltage Game Writers strike, which if people aren't familiar, at Code CWA, we were working with these video game writers who work on a mobile narrative game, and you know, actually one of the most popular in the entire genre. And they came to us, you know, talking about how they had severely, just incredibly unequal conditions compared to writers in the rest of the industry and writing in general. Predominantly, I think a lot of it is because, well, one, working in games typically means you get paid less than the same skill in any other industry. Mm-hmm. And then the vast majority of, you know, actually all of the writers were some combination of women, non-binary folks, LGBTQ, people of color, on and on and on. And so all of those things really boiled down to like, they were making 3 cents a word on average when the average is actually 6 to 8 cents a word. Like, which is like a 50% pay discrimination at best. At best, that's what it is. So they reached out to us very early on. We helped them kind of come together and organize and chart out their workplace. And eventually, like, you know, it built towards a 100% participation strike that lasted for 3 weeks. There was quite a bit of attention, especially partway into it. And, you know, the player base came out in droves in support of the workers, even though at the end, the company was trying to frame it as like, we're so sorry to all the players for this inconvenience, and we're going to get back to making the games you love. And like, all the comments are just like fans being like, yo, shut the fuck up. Like, just pay your workers. Like, we don't care. Like, delay it for 6 months. Just pay your people, please. which I think was really sweet. The fan outpouring was just so positive. So 100% across the board positive. I didn't even see a single negative comment. And they ended up, you know, ultimately making some real gains. On average, they got a 78% pay increase, you know, some as high as like 90-something, some as low as 60-something. And, you know, increases to, or like improvements on like transparency and the ways things were scheduled. There is the reality of the situation, which is that even when you make wins through organizing, at the end of the day, again, the boss, their first motivation is profit and to, you know, hit the bottom line. And so they continue to chip away at those wins even once you've made them. So now they're kind of in this process of like having to defend the things they've won and stick up for each other and make sure they essentially give no quarter to you know, the company and being able to strip away the things they won. But I think it's really phenomenal. I think it's a great example of organizing, and I'm not at all surprised that what I think, or at least seem to know, is the first game worker strike that has ever succeeded, you know, beyond the voice actors. It's arguably, I think, because one, they're kind of on the margins of the industry. They're not AAA game devs. They're like people that no one the press ever cares about or focuses on. They're people who, you know, players don't tend to think of when you think of a game developer. And actually, the bulk of the industry is that. The bulk of the industry works in mobile games. The bulk of the industry works in outsourcing and support firms. That's actually where the industry is. So I'm not surprised when you look at the political economy that that's where organizing really took off in an effective way. Mm-hmm. And I also think, being from marginalized backgrounds, I think really fed into the notion that they knew they were going to have to fight if they were going to get anything out of this. And they weren't willing to give into the notion that maybe if we just ask nice enough, things will work out, you know?
Definitely. Definitely. And I feel like we should ask Austin about what has happened in the UK.
So I would say the UK kind of started shortly after the big 2018 kind of event with at the Game Developers Conference. And like I said, the first kind of big meeting in London was August of that year. And we had a number of other meetings. And then eventually ended up forming as a branch of a union, the Independent Workers of Great Britain. And I guess maybe it's good to clarify a little bit kind of the slight differences in unions between the UK and the US. So in the UK, unions are unattached from workplaces, and you can join or often unattached. And so you can join a union even if you don't have recognition at your workplace. And so in the UK, it was much easier to kind of decide to join up with a union and form a branch. And then all over the UK, we had members kind of join up from tons of different companies to form the branch. So what we've been doing over the last, I guess, almost 2 years now is it's kind of expanding on the branch, recruitment, helping out members who are in the branch with legal casework. So we've had 32 cases with our legal department and won over £100,000 for our members. And so what we're doing now is we're basically trying to, organize, focus on kind of individual workplaces and more work towards the collective bargaining agreements that we can get by having large amounts of workers as members at the workplaces.
So Austin, in terms of, so that's the kind of like getting the basic trade unionism happening, like defending people, winning cases and so on. Like, what do you think has changed in terms of like the organizing more, like how are things developing? What do you think is kind of coming next, I guess?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I'd say when we first started, kind of the big thing was that as a whole, the industry didn't really know that much about unions. And so a lot of what we were doing was just kind of education of, you know, like this is the basics of a union. Like in the UK, you know, you don't have to tell your employer that you're in a union. They're not allowed to ask that sort of thing. What we're doing now is like, which is kind of neat, is that whenever someone has an issue and you know, there's kind of community groups, oftentimes the first thing that they will do that I've seen people do is like, hey, have you talked to the people at the union about your issue? And so like it's really changed the way that people think of the industry as things that they can do to kind of like help improve the working conditions. And one thing that we're trying to do now is basically change people's minds even further from like, oh, this is a reactionary thing that the union can help with, to no, we can be proactive with this kind of stuff. We can improve workplace conditions at individual workplaces before things go bad. Or respond to kind of like issues that have been there for a long period of time. So like the systemic crunch that we talked about earlier, or some of the harassment that the industry had a lot of articles written about and was publicized earlier this year and the previous year. So it's more kind of it is formalized in people's brains that a union is the thing that like can help them, but I don't think that the industry as a whole has really understood like kind of the stepping stones of like, okay, now that we have a union, what's kind of the next step? Like how do we take that and like get our workplaces to get collective bargaining agreements to like push to make changes at the companies, that kind of stuff. So those are the kind of steps that we're taking next.
You know, I think there's a lot that we could kind of, you know, I think what I found so kind of fascinating is seeing this kind of go from the things that happen at GDC to the formation of different kinds of unions and branches, kind of following things along and seeing the progress along the way. And I think, you know, what are we now, 2 years after, maybe longer from that GDC?
Almost going on three, actually. Early next year, it'll be three.
I've completely lost like any sense of calendar time at the moment. It's like it's sometime in 2020. But yeah, I guess must be. Yeah, because it would it be March 2021 would be 3 years?
Yeah. It's interesting. Like I think kind of one of the things that for us in the UK, at least for me, is that it took so much work to kind of get up to the point where we formed a branch of a union, you know, tons of different meetings, figuring out a constitution and like, you know, the fee structure and like basically everything about a branch, and then figuring out how to like run the branch and, you know, how to involve members and everything like that. And like, it's just been like, I never thought like in my brain, because I was so inexperienced, I was like, oh yeah, we'll have like a significant portion of the industry unionized in like a couple of years or something like that. And then now that I'm like 2 years into it, I'm like, oh my God, this is like a monumental task. But like also at the same time, like I can see so much progress being made. And so I think initially I was like, oh yeah, this is gonna be a couple of years and we're gonna have like huge wins. And now I can see it's much longer term than that, but I can also see that like it's gonna be pretty significant. Like we're gonna have huge, huge steps along the way that are just going to be monumental and fantastic.
I feel like it's kind of interesting, the dichotomy between like union legality and kind of culture in the UK versus the United States, because like, you know, I think there's something about having less protections in the United States that's kind of interesting, in that the only way to join the union, like you can't join as like I want to pay dues and I sign up and boom, now I'm in the union. The only way to actually do it is to like engage in class struggle and like actually organize your shop in total. Because you have to like win an election or get recognition and force it as a majority. Anyway, it's kind of, it's a different culture around the unionism, I think, that's more oriented on not membership, but like struggle. And it's just odd.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I think what I always find so like different about the game worker stuff is you have a kind of massive, well, not massive, but you have a large number of people who find each other through this conference online in different countries who want a union in the games industry or want unions in the games industry, but they're kind of starting from outside the workplace and then trying to figure out how to go into the workplace, which is kind of, for lots of people, that's a back to front way, I guess.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. In that way. And it also kind of reminds me of just like over the past 2 years, like so many people have been like, wow, this is great. We're so excited by all the work that you and like other organizers are doing. And like, I can't wait to have a union. And it's like, that's not how anything works. I don't do it. Like I advise people, I train people how to organize. I can provide all kinds of education. I've been there before, so I can like help you, but it's you and your coworkers who need to organize. It's you and your coworkers who need to take up the slack and build something out of nothing and build that community and structure and support. That's what union organizing is. It's not you don't get to check off a box on your dues form and be like, boom, 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 now I'm in it and we have a union and that's it. The primary thing about union organizing is building class consciousness, right? And the primary thing in that is understanding your own power and value as a collective and your weakness as individuals and actually having the agency to move on that and to shape your workplace with that understanding. And until people do that, you will not have a union. Doesn't matter if you support whatever union organizing project there is or a campaign or Game Workers United or whatever your thing is, it doesn't matter. It means kind of nothing unless you yourself are organizing with your coworkers. And it's a thing that I think genuinely every single person can do. I know for a fact because literally nobody on the Voltage Game Writer organizing campaign had ever organized before. Most were scared. They had concerns. They didn't know how to do it. They had to get trained. They took practice. They weren't perfect out of the gate. They messed up. But they kept going and they learned how to do it and now they're killer. They're amazing organizers. And the bond and solidarity they've like built with each other is like just steel, right? They've just like forged such a thing. And so I think there's no passive supporting in the industry. And anyway, it's a tangent sometimes I go on and you kind of jog my memory about it.
Well, I think it's a really important one, that difference of like working class power and a union.
Yeah.
Union is an institution. There are many issues with unions in the UK of that similar model of, you know, you join one of these large unions, you pay your dues, you're not expected to participate in anything. And that doesn't build your power at work.
Right. Because your power isn't in legal protections. It's in the fact that you and your coworkers make absolutely every single ounce of profit and value and quality that your company has. And if you withhold that, that's a hell of a lot of power. That is like severe economic leverage. And we know companies don't make decisions based off of like, you know, fluffy social logic and morals. They're moved by finances. And that's not even necessarily a judgment value. That's just reality. So our greatest power is in our economic leverage we can have collectively. So if you're not doing that, if you're not building that, you can't really accomplish like the significant overhauls of the balance of power you and your coworkers and everyone in the industry needs for the sake of the medium and for the sake of the people who actually make it.
And I'm sure I've told Austin this story so many times, so I'm sorry, Austin, but for everyone else, it might be a new one. Is when I had the ideas about writing Marx at the Arcade, I went to a game studies conference. And talked to some people because I was like, I want to figure out a bit more about, you know, what other research has been done. And I remember this really senior, like game studies professor came and talked to me and he said, you know, Jamie, the problem with you Marxists is you see capital and labor everywhere. And he said, so when you look at the games industry, you see capital and labor. What you don't understand is it's not like that in the games industry. And, you know, it's just because you're a Marxist that you see these things. And he says, you know, there won't be unions that grow. There won't be these things because, you know, this, I used to work in this industry and this industry is different and so on. And so the book in lots of ways, you know, was a two fingers up to be like, see, you know, even you don't have to be a Marxist to see capital and labor in the video games industry. Like people are starting to see how those things work in practice. Right. It's not unique. It's not, you know, a different industry that these things don't work in.
So funny.
It was a satisfaction, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny, like it's such a liberal conception of the world and that like companies are a thing and workers are a thing and bosses are a thing and unions are a thing. And sometimes they just exist. And like, sometimes you don't need one of them. And like, in reality, like unions are not their own third party independent things. It's you and your coworkers in struggle. And people will always engage in struggle in the workplace, in the community, you know, nationally, internationally, so long as there's oppression, so long as you don't control things, so long as you don't have a voice or power to actually impact the world, people mm-hmm. will always push back. And whether you call it a union or a group or a workers' council or whatever, it's still going to be the same damn thing that's pushing back on that oppression. And even if it's relatively light oppression like we have in the games industry in the U.S., like, it still should happen because people deserve to have a voice and a say. A third of our lives or more are spent at work, and it's the most undemocratic, dictatorial, top-down, like, structure you can possibly think of. Like, it just is. But we, like, praise democracy all day long in the United States. But the thing that matters most to me is not who's in the White House. It's, like, the person who's impacting my day-to-day, who decides whether or not my family can put food on the table or pay rent or, you know, have a decent career. And so I'm going off on a total tangent. But, like, the point is, like, unions aren't a thing you get to choose about. So long as there's that dichotomy where, like, a small number of people who are wealthy control everything about your company in reality, then the masses of people below them who don't have that voice and agency will always be wanting more of that. Always. It might take time for them to realize it. It might take time for people to move on that idea, but they will always realize it. People said the same about the steel industry. It will never organize. The workers are too well conditioned, and you know the industry is too monopolistic, and they have all these new production processes. You'll never organize steel. The labor movement thought it. The workers thought it. The capitalists thought it. The politicians thought it. And yet, at some point, a few people got together and were like, screw this. We need to organize this. It's so important. It's the future of the industrial economy, steel. And then they went and did it because they had the guts to do it, right? And I think it's the exact same thing in tech, the exact same thing in games. Just history bears this out time and time again. Just endlessly.
I think that's a really, really good point to move on to the Q&A. Because, you know, I always think about this, like, you know, you might not be interested in class struggle, but class struggle is interested in you. You know,
yeah, it doesn't care if you're engaged.
It doesn't care if you've decided that, like, unions are not for you or the industry is too new or whatever. And this reminds me of a point that I always try and make when talking about this stuff of there's always been resistance in the games industry. You know, there's always been people who didn't want to be talked to that way by their boss or tried to change things or, you know, probably lots of times did it individually and not in a group. You know,
so
that resistance is always there.
People not being credited, like putting their credits into games as Easter eggs because they weren't allowed to have credits. Perfect example.
So we're going to move to do some questions to kind of. So we've had a few come in, but if you have any other questions or things you'd like to get discussed, please do put them in. We've had a few that have come in around game production and kind of specifics about the industry. One of them is, what has your experience been with developer contracts and their duration? So they're saying, for example, between the length of game versus permanent ones and how that affects working conditions or organizing. So job tenure, I guess.
So I think it depends on the, this is a complicated question because it really depends on the type of company. So like AAA or not even AAA, but like super large companies like EA or Ubisoft or Rockstar versus indies. And then also couples with whatever stage the project is in. So if it's in pre-production, prototype, or production, or, you know, kind of like a maintenance mode. So it kind of combines with those. But I would say that for larger companies, oftentimes they do try and, on the games themselves, try and hire as like full-time employees. Contractors are often used as like, oh crap, we need this work done and we need it done in the next 2 months. And so they're kind of like stopgap filled. There's also types of work that is often contractor related because it is not necessarily needed for the entire production of a game. So like localization is often a very contract based thing because it kind of comes towards the end of the game. So it really depends is the answer. But I think for a lot of staff, maybe like the people who have been working on the game throughout the entire life cycle of it, they're oftentimes the full-time employees. And then they're augmented with contract staff. Now, this is true for like kind of the people who directly work on games. But there's also kind of the support staff. So there are companies that are dedicated QA, and oftentimes they will have contract, like solely contract with the QA staff. So the companies will contract out to the QA companies and use them that way. So the direct games are full-time employees, and then kind of everyone surrounding them is often contract. To answer that question, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this stuff, often this stuff matters for how secure people feel at different points, or, you know, if localization happens at a certain stage, when those people could take action is going to be shaped by the kinds of deadlines they might be working around, I guess. We've got another one, which I think also brings up a couple of things that we've touched on kind of briefly at various points, which somebody asks, it's usually just dismissed or used as an insult, but the far right has used games and games culture to recruit to their cause. Is it possible for the left to do the same, or is it just hopelessly right wing out there?
I think that's maybe a little bit of a leading question. I think that
it might be. Yeah,
I'm being kind here. I think that there absolutely is parts of the far right that recruit in video games, including like the American military is recently recruiting using video games and Twitch. But however, I would say a vast portion of the game workers themselves are pretty significant to the left and are willing to, if pushed and taught, are willing to try and to advocate and work towards the things that I think would improve the world.
I think the biggest problem with this entire framing of the question and conception of like solutions to problems that I don't think are problems is that so often the right is not engaging people into active work. In that I mean, like, they're creating a culture, they're creating a rhetoric, they're creating like a mentality, and they suck people into the forums and games and communities and blah, blah, blah. With their kind of worldview, the difference is we don't want to do that. I want to move people out their workplace. I want to build community structures. I want to like build structure that aids in the working classes having power and actually agency. And that takes a ton of work. And I don't think, you know, I don't think it's a matter of like social recruitment through, you know, mediums like this. I think it's a part of it. And like, obviously, we're sitting here playing this because, you know, it's fun and it is a thing that draws people in. But I don't think that's the solution. I think the solution is getting off our asses and talking to our coworkers for once about the things that really matter and actually building that stuff IRL, not to sound like a grandma. But yeah, I feel like it's almost irrelevant to me in the way that I think about it. You know, I think it can play a role, but I don't think it's like some existential problem for the left. I think the left in the West is just really fucking lazy more than anything else. Like the left in the West is pathetic. We're so weak. We don't want to do real struggle. We like to talk and talk and read, but we don't get out there and put that theory to practice. That's the actual problem. The problem that we like would much rather divide ourselves into like 60 different camps of hyper nuanced, ridiculous sectarian groups than actually be like, hey, person in my apartment building, let's organize a tenants union because the guy who's like driving this property into the ground, right? That's the actual problem. So to me, it's definitely not a recruitment issue because I mean, I'll also tell you, like, I've seen people who are essentially like proto-fascists in the games industry flip completely 180 after you get them into union organizing. And literally a year later, they have like a really solid class analysis and they see things totally differently. But you don't change them by engaging in debate. You don't change them by, you know, sneaking them into a games community where it's like, you just start hearing all this Marxist shit. Like, you change them by, you know, forgetting the politics, leaving it at the door and being like, hey man, you, me, our coworkers, everyone around us has X, Y, and Z problems. We need to fix it. And the only way we're gonna do that is if we have the power and voice that is necessary to make that change. And if you can move them on that, and if you can get them pushing against boundaries, if they can start testing the power structure at work, if they can start organizing with their coworkers, that engaging in the class struggle will teach them everything you're wanting to lecture and culture people into being, right? I think there's nothing better than actually doing the organizing and class struggle to change people's politics. And yeah, don't get me wrong, like there's a political motivation definitely behind a lot of the work I do, but lecturing people about it doesn't mean anything, and building, I don't think gaming culture around leftist stuff is the answer either. I think it's just a cute thing that is a part of the general flourishing around this kind of new culture, if that makes sense.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And it strikes me that maybe like Twitter is too much of a focus for some people than, you know, talking to people at work. But I'm going to play the tiniest bit of devil's advocate here, because I mean, I agree with you. You know, I agree with you. I'm a union member. I organize at work. You know, these are things that I think are really important to do. But I also think the left should be able to say things about culture.
Oh, totally.
You know, and I think one of the things that really struck me is, you know, I grew up playing video games, you know, and then I became, you know, a Marxist, got involved in organizing, and those two worlds seem to be completely different. You know, they kind of separate out. And I think being able to intervene in culture and talk about culture is not the only thing we should be doing. But it's kind of remarkable how little, at least like the established left, kind of thinks that video games are this like weird diversion, like maybe a child's toy, maybe not. There's this kind of, you know, a sense that this is like not really a thing that deserves talking about, which I feel has changed. You know, there is, you know, I think because of organizing around it, you know, it now feels like a topic that is worth talking about maybe. But yes, we're certainly not going to win people to revolutionary politics by, you know, playing Papers, Please or something, you know. Okay, so we've got a couple more questions. We've got 10 minutes left. So if you have any other burning questions, I have a couple of final questions that I'm going to ask just to round things up. But one of them, I mean, I know we've talked about this a bit, Austin, is what do you make of, you know, of indie game developers or people who are involved in games but might not have a formal job, and how they fit into the kind of organizing that we've been discussing? And it might just be worth, for people who are a bit less familiar, just giving a quick sense of like what indie work patterns are like, maybe.
Yeah, I guess like, and maybe specifically you're talking about people who are doing this as like side projects type stuff. Is that kind of what you're referring to, or is this question from someone else?
This question came from someone else.
Gotcha.
So indie game devs more broadly, I think.
Yeah. So indie game devs are oftentimes thought of as kind of like smaller operations. So, I mean, there's tons of controversy on like the actual definition of this. So please do not take this as like the actual definition. But, you know, smallish groups of people, 1 to, you know, 30 to 50 people or something like that, can often be thought of as indie devs. And oftentimes they can have different dynamics than kind of the larger developers. And so when people first start, you know, an indie studio, oftentimes like it's like their pet project and they really want it to succeed. And so the there's kind of pressure to make the game that they want to make, and also make it under budget and make sure that the company's successful and everything like that. And so I oftentimes can see indie devs, you know, reaching for crunch as like a solution to those problems, where they're not able to kind of turn off work and kind of go about their normal lives. It's like all work all the time. And so that, I think that can be dangerous at times, just because people are so invested that they essentially don't want to like take care of themselves while they're working.
Yeah. Anything you wanted to add to that, Emma?
I think it's really worth noting to kind of pull out something Austin was talking about, which is really like, I don't think the term indie dev is helpful or useful, because in the category of indie dev, which is big and broad, you have small business owners who control the fate of their workers. You have people in worker co-ops who are egalitarian deciding how the companies run. You have workers who are employed by small business owners. These are very different experiences. And you have single contributor type people who are just making their own thing with like a buddy, right? So I think we need to parse these things out. There are workers in the indie game scene that need to be organized and deserve to be organized, because if you're employed by someone, you deserve to have a group to be with in protection and to advocate for ourselves. So I think that's the main thing I'd want to highlight. Some of the worst exploitation I've ever seen was at small independent studios. So
yeah, for sure. Like some of the companies that we've been dealing with in the UK, indie ones tend to be a lot more questionable oftentimes, because they don't have like the HR structures. They don't have the like quality of life things that the larger companies have been doing for the last 10 plus years or something like that. So yeah, they're definitely some of the bigger issue ones that we've had to deal with.
And people are much more exposed. You know, if you work for a company with five people, you know, if you send an open letter, everyone's going to know it's you, you know, kind of much harder to like, you know, to do those things, I think. Okay. So I had a final question. Like, what do you think the main kind of learning has been from this kind of wave of game worker organizing? And what do you think other groups of workers can learn from this?
I think the big thing for me is that people in the games industry need to understand that there's no change at their workplace unless they involve their own like work, unless they get involved themselves. Oftentimes I kind of hear people say like, oh, hey, there's a union. Great. I've joined it. Good job. Like, you're doing everything. And I'm like, no. Like, you need to get involved if you want to fundamentally change your own workplace. And if you don't, like, it won't happen, period. Like, it'll just be the exact same stuff all the time. As kind of an addition to that, I think a lot of workers can't see or haven't seen maybe like the future or the horizon of like how to get there. I think the like VAL workers strike was like one of the first instances is like, holy shit, like we can do this and like get stuff out of it and like can kind of start to see the roadmap. And I think it'll get really, really huge once we start getting like the collective bargaining agreements and start getting like some of the wins out of it, because I feel like that was similar with like the games press, where they had like one happen and it was like, oh, that was really cool. And then they had another one happen and another one, and it was like, oh shit. And then there was just like a string of them. And I feel like that's going to happen in the games industry too.
COVID-19 pandemic in Canada is serious. We must continue to practice all public health measures. Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands, wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at canada.ca/coronavirus or 1-833-784-4397. A message from the Government of Canada.
Plus que jamais, la santé de tous est entre nos mains. Sur mon cellulaire, l'application Alerte COVID m'avise si j'ai été en contact avec une personne déclarée positive récemment. Du bout des doigts et dans le respect de ma vie privée, je peux protéger ma santé et celle de mes proches simplement en téléchargeant l'application Alerte COVID. Rendez-vous dès maintenant sur québec.ca/alerte-covid pour obtenir plus de renseignements sur l'application et apprendre comment la télécharger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
You're knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station.
Reality. It's a Korean tomorrow.